Well, I'm very, very pleased to welcome the Fremantle Shipping News, David Skerr. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Well, you are the member of the Legislative Assembly, the MLA,
yes,
for the state seat of Coburn.
That's right. Elected in March last year.
18 months ago.
About 18 months ago, yeah.
Well, congratulations belatedly.
Thank you very much.
I keep finding names of people in Parliament I've never heard of, but I knew yours. For some strange reason, you're a lawyer by background.
I am a lawyer by background, and I think once a lawyer, always a lawyer, right, Michael? So I can't say I was a lawyer. I was an industrial relations lawyer before I was elected to Parliament, and I'll let your listeners know that I used to appear in front of you as a lawyer when you were a judge. I was a junior lawyer, no doubt probably testing your patience from time to time, as lawyers do on behalf of their clients.
No comment. look, it really is interesting. The job you have now, which of course over time can turn into being a minister of the government, representing the people of Western Australia, is a really important one. Mm. Tell me, how long did you nurture this desire to seek public office, and how did it all happen in the end?
Yeah, it's one of those questions that you ask yourself, and I've been asked this question before, and I feel like my answer changes every time because I think of something
new. I
keep thinking about it and how I ended up here. So I was born into a politically engaged family. So my parents were both Labor Party members and, you know, trade unionists, and so had always been activists in the workplace or in the community. They were also volunteers as well. You know, they volunteered on the, they were the sorts of parents who volunteered on the school PNC, and they volunteered with the sports club as well. And, you know, I guess I just grew up in a family where that acts of community service were just part of what you did, that you gave back to your community. My parents, my dad in particular, has an interesting background for someone my age anyway, because my dad had me when he was 61 years old, Michael. So my dad was born in 1927, and he was, so therefore, a child of the Depression. He grew up as a young boy. They had their house foreclosed on them in Melbourne by the bank in the, you know, late 1920s, early 1930s, and they lived on in the various houses of members of their church in Melbourne, going from, you know, sort of, what's the word, you know, one member's house to the next as they shared the load around. And Dad had then been training to be deployed in World War II as a fighter pilot. He always says that he was one of a few hundred blokes in Australia who was disappointed when World War II finished, because he wanted to go out and fly fighter planes and all of that. But because of that, Dad, I guess what I'm saying in reference to that is that Dad had, he was from a different generation. He had a different set of values maybe to a lot of people who's my age, the parents of people my age. He believed that Chifley never finished the job in nationalising the banks, and he believed that you were committing treason to own more than just the house that you lived in, because that was denying a house to someone else. So I guess I was raised at the altar of some pretty old school Labor politics. I'm not saying that I share my dad's politics. We used to butt heads about it a lot.
Part of your own heritage, your own growing up.
Yeah.
Your father's not with us now.
No. So he died about almost 8 years ago now, but at the ripe old age of 87. So he had a good innings.
I get a lot of what you're talking about. My father, who passed away a little bit longer than that, but not much. He was born in 1926.
Yeah, there you go.
So what about your mother?
Yeah, so my mother, I suspect closer to your age, if not your age, but my mother was born in 1950.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. And she had me a little bit later as well. She was 35 when she had my sister, 38 when she had me. So big age difference between my parents. And I was Dad's second family, Mum's first family. The way I describe Mum is Mum didn't have the same... Dad was much more, I guess, masculine about his politics, in the sense of, you know, he was very strongly opinionated, and he'd tell you all about the opinions. I used to refer to him when he was alive. I used to tease him and tell him that he was a, I used to describe him as an evangelical atheist, for example, because he was a fierce atheist, but he was just as bad with proselytizing his views as anybody was. And whereas mum was just always much quieter about it, but hardworking, you know, like I think so many women have been over so many centuries probably, which is she was the one toiling away in the background, doing the work, raising my sister and I. Not that my dad was absent. I was very fortunate to have a very present father by virtue of him being older and being retired. But mum grew up in Nanup. She came from a family with sort of different politics. Her grandparents were fierce Labor people, but my grandparents, her parents, were liberal voters. But I think just grew up in a household where they were encouraged to, you know, get an education and engage with local community issues. And as I said before, mum was the, you know, mum volunteered with various community groups. And so I guess I sat around a table each night where we, you know, talked about the politics of the day, and my parents always had the ABC news on. That was the one religion in the family, really, was 7 p.m. ABC News.
Dun, 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 dun.
Yeah, that's right. And so I was just raised in a family where you're always talking about current affairs.
Yes.
But also a family where public service and community service was something that was important.
We don't talk about it perhaps enough generally, whether within a Labor Party context like yours or elsewhere. We've got a national party around the country which is more dedicated to regional and country areas.
Yes.
But you've sort of grown up in the country.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up just outside of Bunbury in Australind. That's where we moved there when I was 3, and then I left Australind when I had graduated high school because I wanted to go and do a law degree, and my only choice, obviously, was to come to Perth to do it. I think then the only choices would have been Murdoch and UWA. Maybe Notre Dame offered law then, but you know, that was my only option. But I don't want to overstate that though, because you know, Bunbury's a big regional centre.
It grows bigger by the day.
When I grew up in Australind, it was still a little bit of a sort of, it was suburban, but it was still a kind of sleepy, separate community a bit from Bunbury. These days, when I've been down there, it's just part of a long stretch of houses between, you know, sort of almost binning up and
We didn't always have the Forest Highway.
Look, I even when I started university, I used to come up the Old Coast Road. It wasn't until I was maybe a year or two, 2007 or thereabouts, I think we must have opened the Forest Highway. It's a big regional centre, Bunbury. So I certainly wasn't the kid that grew up in Leonora or, you know, Meekatharra or somewhere like that.
In a wild preserve outside Nanup.
No, it's funny you say that because obviously my mother, as I said, grew up in Nanup. But there have been some interesting little communities out and around about Nanup. It was about the Orange people or something.
More Manjimup.
Was that Manjimup, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
But you've mentioned how you then come to Perth to do law.
Yes.
And when did you know or think or started to imagine you might do law?
Well, this actually goes back to a person who I think you've interviewed before, which is Melissa Park, the former member for Fremantle.
I have interviewed Melissa before.
Yes. So you might know that Melissa is a Donnybrook girl.
Yes.
And so her parents, George and Lorraine, were good, you know, friends of my parents. And Melissa had, in I think what must have been 1996, 1997, she was the solicitor in charge of the Bunbury Community Legal Centre. So I would have been about 8 or 9. And my father ran her campaign when she was the candidate for what was then the state seat of Mitchell in the 1997, I guess it must have been, state election for the Labor Party. So Dad ran her campaign and struck up a great friendship with Melissa. And then after that, after not succeeding at the election, and I'm sure doing a few other bits and pieces, she then went to, I think her first posting must have been Kosovo, post the war there. And so, and then I think from there she went to Gaza, I think from Gaza to New York, and then she did some work in Lebanon along the way as well. But what I do, I don't remember all the details exactly, but what I do remember as an 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old was that Dad would get these emails from Melissa, which I'm sure were sort of circulars that she sent to all the friends and family back home, saying, you know, this is what's happening in Gaza, or, you know, this is what I'm working on. And I remember there was one email which said that, you know, that, I don't know, she'd been working somewhere and they'd actually had to kind of take cover because there were sort of bullets whizzing through the glass at one point, you know, the windows at one point. Anyway, to a, but she was there doing important, you know, humanitarian work, but with a legal background in terms of helping, in the case of Kosovo, it re-establish its rule of law and its government and a democracy. And as an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old, that was all very seductive to me.
Well, it would be. You realise that the world is a big place, and,
yep,
and you can be out there if you want to be. Did you imagine yourself studying or practising in a particular area of law when you started doing law?
I thought I'd be exactly like Melissa.
Right.
That's what I
You're
thought.
You're going to be a human rights lawyer.
I was going to be a human rights lawyer, and yep, I was going to go and work for the UN, and I was going to go and do, you know, because the lifestyle that she led seemed to be, she seemed to be helping people in a way that also I knew that my strengths were in things like language and speech and sort of communication. And so, you know, that made sense as well. So she was doing helpful work to people using skills that I identified with, but also living what seemed to me to be this sort of exotic, globe-trotting lifestyle.
Particularly when you're at the age you're at.
Yeah.
It looked very glossy.
It looked very, you know, and when she ended up in New York headquarters, and, you know, that all just seemed very kind of glamorous, at the same time as doing good works, I guess. And so I thought, well, what's not to like about this? So I, when Melissa was visiting her parents, she'd often drop in and say hello to our family. And she, I remember very distinctly her chatting with me in our lounge room in Australind. And I said to her, you know, what do I need to do to be like you? And she said, well, you need to go to university and do an arts law degree. And you, when you do your law degree, you have to pick units like international humanitarian law and et cetera, et cetera. And so I said, all right, I'll do it. And so I'm one of those weird kids where probably from about 12, I not only decided I was going to be a lawyer, but I knew very specifically what degree I had to do and where I was going to do it. Yeah.
So just reflecting on your university education, what did you draw from it at the time? Did you get mixed up in student politics?
Yeah, so I didn't get involved in university student politics itself. I was involved with the youth wing of the Labor Party, so I was involved with Young Labor. It's quite funny looking back at it now, I had a girlfriend at the time who was very heavily involved in student politics at UWA, in the guild politics there. And we had this funny relationship where she really looked down her nose on me being involved in Young Labor politics, and I really looked down my nose at her for being involved in university student politics. Looking back on it now, it's all much of a muchness, really, but at the time we thought we were all, you know, it was all different and that ours was better than the other. So I was involved in Young Labor because I'd grown up with the Labor Party, but I'd say with my education, I have to admit I was not always the best law student. And I counsel a lot of younger people now who, for some reason, Michael, I don't know why, but I attract all these young people to work for me who decide they want to go and do law degrees. And I say to all of them, don't do it. You know, I say, why do you want to do it? And they say, oh, we want to change the world. And I say, well, become a social worker then. Don't go and become a lawyer. But they all ignore me and they go and do law. But I always counsel them to be a better student than I was. But I think what I got out of it was, it's that period in your life when you are just learning to be independent. And I struggled a lot with my mental health at that time. I struggled a lot with the realization, I think, that the type of job that I thought I wanted to do was not going to be the job that I was suited to. Because
Very rare jobs.
Very rare jobs, and I got very homesick when I moved out of home to go to university. Mm. And it dawned on me that if I got homesick having moved 170 kilometres away, you know, where I could get home to my parents in
the Gaza
less
Strip
than 2
might,
hours,
might
then
be too far away.
Gaza Strip might be too far away for me. And so I was wrestling with sort of all of that. So, you know, I always say that my marks were a bit of an upside down parabola in terms of the trajectory that they took. You see me sort of pull my finger out at the end of my degree. So I can't say that I necessarily... I'd be interested in your view on this, actually, Michael, because I feel like I learnt a lot of the law once I was actually practising the law.
Well, a podcast for another day.
Yes.
How we educate and train people in anything.
Yes.
Law is all about real life and rules fashioned over centuries and by parliaments on
yes.
the run to make society operate well enough. And when you're 17, 18, 19, you don't fully appreciate what the context is for these laws, but you do over time. Did you ever take anything like a gap year?
I didn't, no. I was very fortunate to receive a scholarship for regional students when I finished high school, and I probably could have deferred it for a year, but my sister had taken a gap year, and that was because I don't know what it's like these days, but back then you could qualify for youth allowance if you earned a certain amount of money within a certain period after graduating high school. But you had to essentially take a year off and work and earn money. And we couldn't afford for, my parents couldn't afford to support us at university, and so my sister did that. Whereas because I got the scholarship, I had a lot of financial assistance. And so for whatever reason, I just decided I didn't need to take the gap year, because in my mind, a gap year was a year that you took off to work, not a year that you took off to go backpacking, because that's what my sister had done. She just worked for a year at a service station. And so it didn't seem very interesting, and so I didn't take the gap year off. I just went straight to university.
It might have offended your father's Labour political principles if you'd done such a thing, David.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Possibly.
Finish up after university, though,
yep.
going into law
mm-hmm.
and discovering that it's actually quite an exciting place to be, and you learn on the job, obviously.
Yes.
So what sort of law do you finish up in at that point?
Yeah, so I end up in industrial relations law, or employment law, however people want to refer to it. And I had not, and this goes to what I said before about how much you learn at university, how much you learn on the job. I never did a single unit of employment law at university. There was an intensive summer unit that Bill Ford ran, but I have to admit, as a young person, the idea of spending my summer doing an intensive unit to learn about employment law didn't thrill me much, so I didn't do it. And I was very fortunate to fall into a job at Slater and Gordon, which is obviously one of those iconic Australian labour law firms, a bit like Maurice Blackburn. And I was given the job by Simon Millman, who is now the member for Mount Lawley in the state parliament, one of my colleagues, and I discovered that law could be, even though I wasn't globe-trotting and, you know, working in war zones or, you know, near war zones or something, that I could still make a difference in people's lives in a different way.
I thought you said you were working in industrial law.
Yeah, true. It is a bit of a war zone sometimes, isn't it? Yeah, that's true. But yeah, I just discovered that there was a different branch of law that interested me, and I think actually going to that point about it being a bit of a war zone, I liked that it was a bit political as well. That's obviously attracted people from both sides of politics to industrial relations for a long time. You know, I think Michaelia Cash, the senator, is a former industrial relations lawyer who worked at, I think, Three Hills, and you know, Simon Millman, obviously, you know, my practice group leader at the time, went on to state parliament as well. So it's a pretty well-trodden road that I took.
You didn't stay there?
I didn't stay there. Oh, at Slater and Gordon?
Yes.
No, I didn't stay there at Slater and Gordon. I stayed there for probably about, I guess, about 3 or 4 years.
Mm.
Did my training there. I'm very fortunate to work on some pretty aggressively litigated matters. The CFMEU was one of my clients. As I'm sure your listeners will know, they're a union that is pretty militant about what they do, and also litigates fairly fiercely and robustly as well. And so I was lucky to work with some great barristers as well as solicitors. But yeah, after a few years, the I went off to help start a new law firm called Eureka Lawyers.
What a great name.
Thank you, Michael.
We forget about Eureka. You're of a generation. What generation are you?
I'm Gen Y. I'm a millennial.
Gen Y. I'm from the baby boomers first category.
Yes.
For us, growing up, Eureka was a symbol that we really took to heart because it indicated the sort of Australia, the independent sort of Australia
yes.
we wanted to see at that age.
Yes.
Why did you choose Eureka?
Look, I have to admit, Michael, that when we were choosing the name, we went with Eureka because we wanted a brand that was emotive of our links to the trade union movement, and the Eureka flag and the story of the Eureka stockade has been taken up by the union movement over many, many years. So it was an exercise in, I think, two things. You know, one in just sort of general branding, in terms of we wanted to be a law firm that appealed to that type of business. But secondly, and more importantly, our sort of, not our slogan, but our byline that we used is, we would say it was a law firm for workers, run by workers. We were owned by a union. We were the lawyers who were directors were union members and had run for union clients. And so we wanted to say to people, if you come to us, you get the genuine experience of, you know, battling against the top end of town, and we'll do the best by you. And I think Eureka sort of evokes that for people, right? It was about the kind of the little guy battling against the big guy, which is what we wanted to evoke. I did make a joke when we started it, though, that really the story of the Eureka Stockade is arguably about small business, micro businesses defending their position when it comes to taxation. Less so that it is about solidarity amongst the working class, but events have a way over the course of history of being interpreted and reinterpreted. And I think we can safely say Eureka Stockade these days is sort of synonymous with the growth of the trade union movement in Australia.
I grew up in an era, as I started to foreshadow, where in Australian politics, the DLP had not long come into existence out of the Labor Party, the Catholic component, those who went. The Liberal Party had just defined itself not long beforehand. And you had these two dominant forces in Australian politics. Mm. And on the face of it, things are still largely that way.
Mm.
But we had this amazing phenomenon at the last federal election where the so-called teal candidates, well-equipped, impressive, mainly young women, older women, but they've come into politics in like a storm through off the sea.
Yep.
What do you see being the significance of that? Is there a change going on?
I think there's probably two ways that I look at it. The first is specifically about the teals, and I think that there are some particular lessons from the teals, because I think the teals reflect the rise of the teals reflects the way that the Liberal Party has moved further away from its traditional base. Its traditional base of socially progressive but not radical, fiscally conservative, small L liberal business owners, believers in sort of rugged individualism or entrepreneurialism, for want of a better term. I think the Liberal Party has drifted away from that, and these days is much more what you might call a conservative party. It's increasingly become a party over the last few decades that is concerned about sort of cultural and ideological wars. And you look at that, I give the example of, say, climate change, where it's really not an issue that ought to be subject to too much ideological debate. You should just be able to look at the science and make an assessment, and or if you're a business owner, look at the commercial realities of what it means to move to a low carbon economy. And you know, you don't need to make it an ideological war, but the Liberal Party chose, you know, probably about 15 years ago now under Tony Abbott to turn that into an ideological dispute. And so I think that as they've become more, I guess, more extreme in some of those respects and more ideological, they've lost some of that base, which is a base which is, as I say, socially progressive, fiscally conservative. And I think if you look at the people who have been elected, someone like Kate Chaney in Curtin, you know, the Chaney name is synonymous in WA with the Liberal Party in some ways, and has a great, obviously the Cheneys have a great history in the Liberal Party, but they represent that brand of Liberal that I was talking about before, the, you know, business people want to advance advance society through entrepreneurialism, but still want a progressive conversation around things like Aboriginal land rights, as Fred Cheney was a great leader in. And so I don't think it's surprising that someone like Kate, who represents that old style of Liberal, attracted enough support from disaffected Liberals, Liberals who had been disaffected by the party's position on things like climate and integrity, to be successful. I'll just say very briefly, the second observation I think you can make, though, is the observation about the decline of the major party vote generally, because that's not just about the Teals, that's about the Greens, that's about the rise of, say, One Nation, the resurgence of One Nation in recent times, and a lot of other micro-parties as well. I was looking at the predicted results of the Victorian upper house. And I mean, even our upper house here, we have two members of the Legalised Cannabis Party and only one member of the Greens in our upper house.
So Victorian upper house, though, had the preference whisperer.
It did, and it's the last state that has group voting tickets left on their election, which, you know, I hope they change at some point, because everyone else has seen the light on that. But there has been this rise in the minor party and micro party vote right across the spectrum. You have, on the left side, you obviously have the Greens as a pretty significant minor party, but then you do have these other parties now snapping at their heels, like the Animal Justice Party and the Legalised Cannabis Party. And then on the right side of the spectrum, you have sort of One Nation as, again, a sort of fairly significant force, not as much as the Greens are, but a fairly significant force. But then you have these other micro parties that pop up from time to time, or characters like Palmer, Clive Palmer, that pop up from time to time. So I don't know what conclusions I could draw from it, but I could definitely agree with you that, yes, while our preferential voting system has largely kept in place the two-party system, it doesn't reflect the way that people used to be rusted on to the major party.
All that being said, what do you see as the big public policy issues of our time?
I think I have to say climate change. It's I have to admit, one of the issues where I don't feel like I'm particularly well versed. You know, I was, as we've just covered, an industrial relations lawyer, and I care deeply about the environment and the climate, but it's one of those issues where I always feel like I'm a bit technically out of my depth. It's one of those areas where I trust the experts, I trust the climate scientists on it, and so I can't say that it's an area where, unlike some of the other people you might have interviewed, I feel like I can make a big academic contribution to it, but it's plainly something that is on everybody's mind. I've run the first, what I call the Coburn Environmental Leadership Program this year, where I had year five students from all the primary schools in my electorate come to do a day of activities where they learned and did workshops with various sort of environmental experts. And these are year five kids, so they must be about 10, all preoccupied with actually climate change, but the other thing was biodiversity loss, was extinction of species as well. So it's on the minds of children, but it's also on the minds of business, it's on the minds of industry. You know, we are all talking about how do we get to holy grails like producing green steel, how do we transition our electricity grid from fossil fuels to green energy. So I would absolutely say, you know, climate change is really the number one issue. In terms of other issues, I would say there's an increasing concern about inequality in our society, and I mean that in a few different dimensions. I think that we saw feels like ancient history now, but you know, the marriage equality debate just a few years ago, which was obviously resulted in a resounding yes vote. If I think back 10 years before that, when I was a young activist, I remember when WA Young Labor was one of the first sort of political organisations to pass a motion calling for marriage equality, and that would have been in about 2007 or something. And to think that less than 10 years later, we legislated for it. So I think that's a demonstration of people's interest in ensuring equal rights, whether it's for LGBTIQA+ people, or if it's something like our Indigenous brothers and sisters through a voice to parliament, which is obviously a hot topic at the moment. But then I also think people are increasingly concerned about inequality in an economic sense as well. You know, there's a lot of debates going on around Australia at the moment, for example, about the profits that gas companies are making during a time of geopolitical strife. And you know, we've just had the federal government recall parliament to, I think they're sitting on tomorrow, to go and put price caps on coal and natural gas, which I think even 12 months ago would have been unthinkable in the Australian political climate, and they're being really cheered on by the Australian public to do it.
Well, your father and Ben Chifley would have been, would have been supporters as well.
Yeah, that's right.
It is fascinating. We, to some extent, over the last 40 years, as I see it, have had a much more ideologically free mm-hmm. way of approaching big public policy issues mm-hmm. until, as you've said, in some areas like climate, mm-hmm. it seemed to become highly ideological. From where you now sit on a seat in the state parliament, mm. in the lower house, an important position in a time-honoured party, the Labor Party, mm. which has its own internal structures.
Yes.
But when it comes to these sorts of issues, like environment or mm. any other major public policy, what can a humble old Labor backbencher do?
It's a good question, because one of the things that you have seen in the last few decades has been the maybe you might call it the professionalisation of public policy, where ideas like Medicare, which originally came off the floor of the Labor Party state conference with delegates, you know, just having a fight, branch rank and file union and branch delegates having a fight about it, and then coming up with a policy, and then a Labor government getting elected and implementing it. You don't see as much of that anymore, because, and I'm in two minds about this, because on the one hand, I think it's a good thing that we are using evidence-based public policy as much as we can, and that we are listening to people who are experts, and that we are alive to the fact that when you make public policy, you can create unintended consequences, and you can create these negative feedback loops where a program that you intended to achieve one thing actually ends up trapping people in, you know, welfare dependence or something like that. So I think, on the one hand, I think it's a good thing that we've professionalised our politics. But on the other hand, I sometimes worry that we try to suck all of the values out of our politics as well. I'm studying a Master of Public Policy part-time through the ANU at the moment. And I have to admit, I get a little bit frustrated with some of the... most of my fellow students are public servants of various seniority, and their answer a lot of the time to an issue is, well, you know, what does the evidence say? And sometimes I have to say to them, well, you first got to decide what you want to achieve from a normative perspective. You know, what do you see as a desirable society? Because if the evidence tells you that this policy is going to be very good at, I don't know, redistributing wealth amongst a great number of people, that's great that the evidence tells you that, but you do have to have the debate first about whether or not it's a good thing to redistribute wealth amongst a great number of people. Now, I personally think it is. That's a value that I hold, and it's an ethical debate that I'm happy to enter into. But somebody who holds the view that, no, you should be rewarded for your efforts in life, and your personal property rights should be respected, and the government has no business in redistributing the wealth that you've generated through your labour and your innovation, says, well, it doesn't matter what your evidence says, that's a terrible policy. And so I do think, What I'm saying is that I think it's a good thing that we have access to more information and more expertise, but there is still a place for old-fashioned debate about what are the values and what is the type of society that we want to live in.
So, do political parties, through their structure, at the lowest level, you're in Coburn, I'm assuming there's all sorts of local branches and divisions, and the party must have big policy committees that you might well be on and contribute to.
Yep.
Is that the way it is? Is it alive and well? Can you expect people to be making meaningful contributions in that system?
It's a bit cyclical in the sense that, you know, obviously the Labor Party's in government here in Western Australia. It has a very significant majority. It's in its second term. And so we have access to the expertise of the public sector. You know, we have ministers who are paid full time to, you know, administer departments and drive an agenda. And so in that environment, perhaps counterintuitively, when a political party is in government, is to many people actually the most attractive time to get involved, because they think to themselves, well, now's the time when we can implement things and make change. But it's actually also the time when perhaps you get the least say in it, because the party has so many other resources that it can draw on and has so many other demands on it. Whereas when you're in opposition, which can be a very unglamorous time to be involved in politics, because it's a lot of hard work and a lot of getting no headlines in the media, that actually is the time often when the party is casting around for what is our new agenda, what is going to be our point of difference, how are we going to get back into government. So I think your summary of how political parties work in terms of there being various committees and various structures is all correct. I think I'd have to do a PhD on how exactly the Labor Party works, and even then, by the time I'd finished it, I'd probably have to start it again with a new thesis, because things would have changed. But I would say to people, yes, you know, you can still have your say, but yeah, there are sometimes times when it's easier to have your say and times when it's harder, and they're not always the times you think it's going to be.
Tell our listeners, from your experience over the last 18 months or so, what the humble back bencher in Coburn does on a daily basis. Do you get up early and go for a run on the beach? Do you go down the gym? Do you get to the office at 6 o'clock? Do you have a routine? Do you have engagements with your community on set times? Do you then have to rush off and do other things? And how often, and how do you prepare for sittings of Parliament?
Yeah, so it's both the best part and the worst part of my job is that I don't really have a routine. It's a job that's quite difficult to have a routine in, because you have got various invitations to community functions, or a particular issue erupts in a local area and you have to deal with it and speak to constituents about that issue. And so I don't have a very good routine. But I love that about the job, because I love that it's always different. I love that, I think of a day a few weeks ago where I started the day talking to the, I can't quite remember the name, I think it's the WA Justice Association, and it's a group of young people who are pressing for sort of criminal justice reform. Had a meeting with them to hear about their ideas and what I could do to sort of facilitate any of those ideas. And then I think the next, as I showed them out the door, the next people that came in were meeting with me about a problem house where, you know, they were concerned about kind of criminal elements happening at the house in their street. And so you go from kind of one issue to another that almost have, in that case actually have a little bit to do with one another, but you know, you can really be pulled in very different directions on a single day. I used to have a ritual of going down to Coogee Beach just about every day and just going for a bit of a swim down there, because I found it cleared my head, but I have to admit the last 12 months I haven't been so good at that. But in terms of what the job entails, I tell people it's as big or as small as you want it to be in some sense. It's kind of whatever you make it to be. I, for example, have a I have a discipline of door knocking for 2 hours every Saturday. Now, I don't do every Saturday. You know, sometimes things get in the way or I take some time off. But by and large, I door knock for 2 hours every Saturday, and that is predictable, and that's in my diary every week. And I do that for a series of reasons. I do it because it's important for me. You know, if I just sat around my office waiting for people to come to me with issues, most of the time I'd barely ever hear from anyone. So it's important to keep my finger on the, in terms of keeping my finger on the pulse of what's happening in my electorate. It's obviously got electoral benefits to me as well, because I get my name and my face out there and talk to people. And then I also do it because I think I just have a moral obligation. I asked people to vote for me, and they did vote for me, and I'm going to ask them to vote for me again in about 2 years' time. And so I've got an obligation to make myself as available and as proactive as I can be. But, and this is, I say this without criticism, I have colleagues who maybe don't door knock at all because they prefer to engage with people in a different way. In terms of Parliament, Parliament's a, it's a funny institution. I have said to people before that if you said to someone today, design the least productive workplace that you could possibly imagine, then they probably, a consultant would probably come up with Parliament, because we are doing things basically the same way that they've been done in the UK House of Commons for several hundred years now. So I'll give an example of how slow we are to move on things. It wasn't until last year when Michelle Roberts, who's the current Speaker and the first woman to be Speaker of the Legislative Assembly, declared that members would be allowed to breastfeed any babies that, you know, they might have in the chamber, which, you know, is pretty extraordinary that up until last year, women who were MPs who'd had kids weren't even allowed to bring their kids into the chamber to breastfeed them. I do note, though, that we didn't make a determination that MPs could bottle feed their babies in the chamber, so it's yet to be established whether or not a man could be bottle feeding their baby in the chamber. So we've taken a while to catch up with the workplace in terms of that family-friendly stuff.
Well, there's always been a lot of criticism about the, in some cases, ridiculous hours that people work. Yes. And how can you be productive when you filibuster or you
yes.
sit and try and do things for so long?
But yes.
And I think this is an issue in all parliaments, mm-hmm. and people are trying to introduce more family-friendly
yes.
hours. But at a broader level, there's this question of you know, life-work balance.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that?
I am not very successful at handling that, Michael, I have to say. My wife and I don't yet have children, which makes my life, I think, my work-life balance a whole lot easier than it is for some of my colleagues. But I, you know, hopefully children are in my near future, and I'll have to work out then how to deal with that. I think the difference is, I think work-life balance is important, and I, as a union lawyer, was always passionate about ensuring that people were properly remunerated and were given proper conditions at work, including not just the financial remuneration, but things like breaks and being able to, you know, work a 38-hour week rather than, you know, having to do, you know, 90-hour weeks or something, even though a lot of people in Australia do that when they do overtime. So I was passionate about that, and so I should put my money where my mouth is and sort of role model my own values. But I guess the way I think about being a Member of Parliament is that it's not really a job in the traditional sense of the word. I mean, I'm technically not an employee. I have no leave entitlements. I don't have annual leave entitlements or sick leave entitlements or anything like that. I don't technically have an employer. My employer is essentially the 30,000 people who live in my electorate of Coburn. And so I think if you make the decision to put your hand up for elected office, that you probably to some extent do so knowing that your work-life balance is going to be skewed more in favour of work than it is in favour of life.
David, we're getting towards the end of our conversation. It's very interesting. You've only just been there for a relatively short time.
Yes.
There will have been a period when you will have been ambitious for the job and,
yes.
and you get it. And I'll say that in a complimentary way because you're the sort of person one expects to find their way into Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some ambitions that you've got as a parliamentarian that you'd like to see happen over time?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I thought I had an answer to that and then I got elected to the job and my answers have changed.
Mm.
I would just give one example of that. I think when you are on the outside looking in, you imagine making the big changes like the Medicares and the compulsory superannuations of the world.
The human rights lawyer.
Yeah, that's right, with the sort of lofty ambitions. Now, having been in the job for about 18 months, I would say I am much more focused on something a little bit smaller and a little bit more local. So, for example, I engage a lot with the schools in my electorate, primary schools and high schools, public and Catholic. Public schooling is my particular passion, having been a public school boy myself and believing very much in the transformative power of public education. And so I would say without going into the details, one of the causes I've really taken up is just about ensuring that kids in some of the lower socioeconomic parts of my electorate are getting access to the same quality public education that you might get elsewhere. I don't think it's a secret that, for example, schools like, say, Ross Moyne Senior High School or Shenton College are particularly sought after because they are public schools, but they're public schools with, sort of enviable reputations. And I want to see, I guess, maybe less of the I don't want to say inequality, but the difference in I don't think your postcode should determine the quality of the public education that you get. And I think sometimes we do see that in our public education system. So my interest now is very much more on just sort of making sure that the schools in my electorate are getting the support that they can to run, good vocational education training programs, being able to offer ATAR courses to kids. Even if there's only three or four kids in the school who want to study, calculus or physics or whatever it is, making sure that they get the opportunity to do so. So I would say that, my loftier ambitions have now focused more on delivering what is still, in my view, social justice, but at a local community level.
And from your electorate point of view, looking back at you, as ill-defined as the electorate is,
yes.
Do you think they have particular ambitions for you? Do the people of Cockburn have some particular projects or outcomes that they're looking for?
Look, I've certainly had I've been happy that I've got some good feedback from constituents in the last 18 months that people are, really happy that I keep active and that I try to be proactive as well. And so I think generally people are happy that they've got someone who represents them in a sort of active way. And I always explain to people, I've got 30,000 constituents and I haven't yet been able to make them all happy at the same time. I doubt I ever will. But people appreciate that even if I disagree with them, that I respond to their emails or I pick up the phone and give them a phone call or I knock on their door. And it seems to me, are crying out for that kind of just grassroots, old-fashioned, local politics. In terms of their aspirations for me, there are issues going around. Seeing as we're getting to the end of things, I won't go into the detail, but obviously Cockburn cement has been an issue that has popped up lately and which I've been advocating around for my constituents. And so there are some issues where I think, that's a very specific issue where I certainly think that some suburbs, my own suburb of Bealey are included, where residents want to see change. But in a general sense, as you say, in the electorate, in the kind of general sense, I think there's a genuine interest in just having a member of parliament who just puts the time into listening, explaining where you agree and disagree, trying to find compromises and trying to find consensus on issues, and ultimately trying to deliver things. I had a conversation just this morning where I was told that a particular resident didn't want a project done in a particular way, and I had to say to them, well, you know, my philosophy very much is don't let perfect get in the way of good. And, you know, I think that provided that you have that conversation with people and you consult with people and you listen to people, you know, I still think that, I think that's what people are looking for in their elected representatives. They'd much rather someone who takes the time and tells them no, but explains why, takes the time to explain why, than somebody who promises them the world or agrees with everything that they have to say, but never actually manages to deliver on it.
David, it's been lovely talking to you. Thank you for listening and explaining. And good luck with the remainder of this term, and we'll watch with interest.
Thank you very much, Michael.